This podcast is presented by Convergence, a magazine for radical insights.
As Reagan first came in, with him came the evangelicals, came the moral majority. And I feel like those groups, those people, were very manipulated by right-wing leadership to bring them from their beliefs around religion and church and practice to believing that that was being threatened by what they were seeing that appeared new to them.
Welcome to the Anti-Authoritarian Podcast, a project of the 22nd Century Initiative. I'm Scott Nakagawa, one of your hosts.
Hello, friends. I'm co-host Sue Hyde. Scott and I first joined forces about 30 years ago to help defeat anti-LGBTQ ballot measures proposed by Christian authoritarian groups.
It was as true then as it is now that those of us who believe in democracy make up a supermajority of people in this country. The challenge is, how do we go from being the majority to acting like the majority?
We dig into strategy questions like these and prescriptions for change. We talk with expert guests and commentators whose scholarship, political activism, and organizing define the cutting edge of anti-authoritarian resistance. Thank you for joining us.
Today we are exploring the question, how did we end up in the crisis of democracy we're now in, and what should we be doing about it?
Our guest is our friend Suzanne Farr, who will celebrate her 85th birthday shortly. She's lived through decades of struggle for social justice and human rights. Along the way, she's done a lot of organizing in many social justice movements. She's worked on historic campaigns against authoritarian attempts to exploit popular prejudice for political and financial gain. And she's written some books you may find interesting. Homophobia, A Weapon of Sexism, is one of the groundbreaking books of second wave feminism published in 1988. Suzanne wrote In the Time of the Right, Reflections on Liberation, a book that helps to expose the threat to democracy. And wait for it, it was published in 1996. Talk about prophets. Suzanne is also the author of Transformation Toward a People's Democracy. She joins us today to share some of her experiences and the wisdom she has gained along the way.
We often talk about the rise of authoritarian movements and the takeover of one of our two political parties as a 60-year process. But Suzanne, you were a frontline activist through all of those years, and one of the most astute and compassionate observers of the progress of authoritarian movements. And I don't just say that because you're my friend. You are also someone who has helped thousands of social justice activists better understand threats to democracy in what Dr. King termed mutual interdependence, the web of mutuality in which the fates of all of us are deeply intertwined. Thanks for joining us, Suzanne.
Thanks for having me here.
In this podcast, we're going to be talking a lot about the authoritarian movement strategies and how they have evolved over time. But it's equally, if not more important for us to know what we are for. Suzanne, you have been involved in social movements for a long time now. How did we get to this moment in which democracy in the U.S. is so threatened?
That's a very, very big question because it covers a very long time. That some of us that we work with, some according to a generation, according to other things of when they came into movement work, think that it maybe happened just recently, maybe in the last 10 years or the last 15 years. What we know is that it has been going for about 60 years at a very steady speed that then accelerated. It's not that there wasn't something before the last 60 years before it started, but most of us, I think it started around the time of Goldwater running for president and started moving on then. I would have to say that great numbers of us failed to recognize that it was happening, that we didn't realize clearly or fully that this was a long, long-term effort of a takeover and a transformation of the country. I think we recognized there was a threat, you know. We knew many pieces. We knew, for example, that when people started attacking women and queers, you know, around late 70s, 1980s, there was something in the air. You know, there was something odd. Beginning to put that together with abortion, beginning to put that together with women's rights, you know, those kinds of things that are so alive and vigorous now. We knew were threats, but it was hard in some cases, I think, to get the attention of the country. So the real attention, I believe, has become probably the clearest since the great September 11th attack that seemed to have some way have opened the eyes of lots of people in odd kinds of ways, not because of the attack, but how the country responded to the attack. And so with that eye opening, instead of having 20 people who were studying this or watching this, writing about this, you suddenly had a number of people who were able to bring it forward. And we began to, as people began to give notice to it, all of us began to gather that it was indeed a threat to democracy.
So Suzanne, you said that, you know, many people over the course of those 6 years didn't notice. Why do you think that is?
I think they were busy enjoying what Reagan was doing, which is an unfortunate statement to have to make. I think there was not the attention, because the attention was going elsewhere. I mean, there were other causes, but much of the attention was drawn through the activities of Reagan. My partner and I were talking about this morning, that say there was a ladder, he took out the rungs of the ladder for every institution that he could that offered justice. You know, it began, you know, right away with an attack on unions. It led from that eventually to the racialization of every issue that you can imagine. This is the same time that he's working on economics, he's working on the political sector, and he's working on economics at the same time. And so we're seeing a radical change in how we live. And I think we were distracted by that and saw it as conservatism at work rather than what was actually at work, which is what we now call authoritarianism.
Hello, I'm Marcy Ryan, and I'm the print editor for Convergence. If you're enjoying this show like I am, I hope you'll consider subscribing to Convergence. We're a small, independent operation and rely heavily on our readers and listeners like you to support our work. You can become a subscriber at convergencemag.com/donate. You'll find a direct link in the show notes. Subscriptions start at just $10 a month, or you can make a one-time donation of any amount. At any donation level, know that you're helping to build a better media system, one that supports people's movements and fights fascism. But at $10 monthly and above, you'll have access to exclusive content and events. If you can't afford anything right now, don't worry. Our shows and print content will continue to be free for you to enjoy. You can also help by leaving us a positive review or sharing this episode with a comrade, a friend, or a family member. Thank you so much for listening.
Suzanne, I'm glad you mentioned the Reagan administration, because in my mind, that was a pivotal time politically for the, I'm going to call it the white Christian movement to ascend to a kind of political power that I'm not really sure they ever had before the Reagan administration. And it was also a petri dish of anti-LGBTQ poison. And I know you've thought a lot about this, and I'm curious if you could speak about the authoritarian movement's intense focus on LGBTQ people and communities. What are they getting out of this? What are they mobilizing? What's behind it?
Well, I think they're mobilizing a number of things. And I'm thinking about, You know, as Reagan first came in, with him came the evangelicals, came the moral majority. And I feel like those groups, those people, were very manipulated by right-wing leadership to bring them from their beliefs around religion and church and practice to believing that that was being threatened by what they were seeing that appeared new to them, you know, the liberation that appeared new to them. And so Reagan and others were able to build on that, you know, to make that grow into a political base of that fear and that antagonism. I think the other thing in that is, I always think back to Hitler, you know, and the persecution of gay men. And that takes me to the whole idea of the strong man, what we witness now in our politics, you know, that search for the strong, authoritative leader, not only in this country, but in other countries that are moving toward authoritarianism. And, I mean, Reagan was that strong man. The beginning of that, I believe. I don't think in the time before that we were really having that person as president. I think that grew. And so gender, not just queerness, but gender became the issue where the attack was. Because what was moving in gender was homosexuality, the language we used then, and basically gender freedom for women and equality. It's hard to have a strong man with those components out there in the world. And so there had to be some attack on that. And then that use that to build a base, build that base on fear, build that base on threat, particularly build that base on if these people have freedom, you are going to lose something. It's not just you're just going to have a sense that it's illegal. It's not just you're going to have a sense that it's immoral. You're going to lose something from them. And I think certainly those who were leading it were of the strong man kind of leadership, seeking that through, you know, authoritarianism. And I think where we failed was that we should have focused in on what was being liberated in that, which, you know, in the way of gender. And also to see that the strong man, how authoritarianism builds, as far as I'm concerned, its earliest base is the family. That strong man structure of the family that has to be fought for, maintained, or else we could lose control of everything. So that becomes the structure that is built and is replicated into political leadership. So queers became just a money pool for them, you know, for the building of fear and the building of confusion and the building of anguish and uncertainty. And always that sense that, you know, that you're going to lose something if other people gain freedom, you're going to lose something. And in the political spectrum, that what you're going to lose is authority. But on the ground, you're going to lose control. You know, you're going to lose control of your families. You're going to lose control of these women. The women are going to be able to do whatever they want to. Who are we going to get to work? Who's going to take care of our houses? Who's going to take care of our children? Who's going to maintain this? And of queers, I think it's fascinating to me that prior to the 30s, there was a fair amount of freedom for queers, a lot of joyousness, you know? And that joy, that sense of we can seek freedom and have pleasure in ways that are not considered the way to have that pleasure, was embraced strongly by people, I think, in the 20s. And then people were trained to be terrified of it in the 30s. To me, it's a very complicated thing. But I always think about if we're going to make change, we have to think about the family and how we rethink it.
Mm-hmm.
And not only rethink it, we've got to reshape it. We've got to, you know, broaden it extraordinarily. And also still use it within the structure of how we live in society.
And the AIDS crisis raised, they weren't new questions, but many very pertinent questions about families, family structures, mm-hmm. who is included in families, who is not included in families, who gets to decide where a person will be buried or in what way. Gosh, it was quite a struggle for many many people. Mm-hmm. Both people who were dying and people who were taking care of people who were dying, as to where did they fit in their family of origin? Where did they fit in their chosen family? So,
you know, what's interesting to me, Sue, is that gave us more opportunity to examine family than anything else I can think of in that period. And the marriage effort denied us a lot of that opportunity to examine family. Because in the AIDS crisis, you saw all the configurations of family. People became family in the most intense ways. You know, after that, we used the word family within the queer movement over and over and over. We still do. You know, our joy for it, our wish for it, our hope for it, our protection of it. But once we decided that marriage was the signature issue for the queer community, it became more talking about what was already there, that you marry, that you may have children or not have children, you have divorces like everybody else. It sort of clamped in the idea of family even more so, I think, instead of busting it open. I mean, on some level, it opened it up, and that, you know, everyone who sees me with my partner at the doctor's office ask me, do I want my wife to come in? And I say, I don't have a wife. I don't believe in marriage, but here is my 35-year-long partner. It's shocking to them, but they have made progress that they ask me. So, you know, I'm like, I'm standing on one hand. This is great. They ask me, is this my wife? We've gone somewhere. And then I think, Suzanne, are you sure? You don't think that's great? But it is that recognition and that effort is there. It's a little like the effort toward pronouns being there. Is it, you know, is a good thing? Does it get us where we want to go is another question.
Mm-hmm. It's quite a pivot, isn't it, from you should never get married to why aren't you married? Right. It really speaks to what you're talking about, which is that the same gender marriage struggle really didn't challenge the rigid and a kind of authoritarian structure of families, right? And didn't get to that really that nut of what I think some people call systemic authoritarianism. So not political authoritarianism, yes, like a takeover, but systemic authoritarianism in the way that authoritarianism organizes our daily lives and the ways in which we normalize that.
It's a systemic authoritarianism that maintains the other authoritarianism. You know, it's what makes people ready to accept what they're hearing that holds the higher authority in it.
Mm-hmm. It is sort of the original authoritarian arrangement that we all learn of, right? One in which the children are incompetent to make decisions and so the adults must decide for us, that makes authoritarianism actually appealing to a lot of people. And, mm-hmm. you know, you were in the battered women's movement, which, by the way, for our audience, was one of the most underrated mass social movements of our time. But the battered women's movement, which started out as a liberation movement, according to the story you've told me many times, Suzanne, and then evolved, a part of it at least, into a kind of a law and order movement, largely as a result of succumbing to this sort of authoritarian idea, right? That in a vulnerable situation where people are being harmed, where people feel they are in danger, that they are willing to accept one form of authoritarianism over another in order to be able to be safe. And in our very increasingly, you know, toxic and, you know, conflict-filled time, it seems to be a direction a number of people are going in. So what lessons can we learn from the battered women's movement that would be helpful to us now in terms of that pivot and where the movement has gone since its early days as an anti-violence movement led by women bent on liberation?
I would like to note that some of my most brilliant analysis and writing has come from women who were part of that movement. particularly mm-hmm. the writings of Black women in the 90s and after in this century has been extraordinary because of, one, the organizing from within that movement, which was tough, you know, to have from 1977 or so to gain recognition and then to be able to have any kind of power in the movement. But it's the leadership of Black women that led the movement to know that this turn to the police was really, really wrong and a bad move. And that was helpful. So I think there's something to be said about who leads, who's listened to, whose messages are there at the center of what you're talking about. And, you know, we always said we listen most to those who experience the violence, but we didn't necessarily listen to the most who had the largest in numbers experiencing that violence and support that leadership happening. But when that happened, you know, it was a significant change. The other thing that happened to the movement was, to go back to what you said, you know, that it was in the beginning, it was a very much based, not in money, not in, you know, even having a place, but figuring out how to make a woman safe, how to move her from one safe house to another, how to create a shelter, you know, how to create a hotline that they could call, very much based from people's work on the ground. And then finally organized in a coalition. And that coalition, I think, was significantly important because it was representatives of women from every state coming together and we're, you know, sharing ideas in conferences, sharing ideas in workshops. But then there's always this issue of money. And I think this is true of organizations now. When you're that sort of community-based, you know, kind of free organization, and then you try, you know, to get your property, get your pay, you know, salaries, get your whatever, it becomes more conservative because people, one, are seeking ways to get that money, you know, not to be too far out on the line with feminism, not to be too far on the line with this. And I think the same thing is happening in our nonprofits now, or has happened, that the battle for money has made them more conservative and less out on the, they're out on the, more out on the front lines when it comes to protests, but not out on the front lines when it comes to strategy. And I think that's where we really have a problem, that we've got to find that place where we don't worry all the time about our funders and we don't worry all the time about our competition with each other, mm-hmm. but instead that we have collective work. I mean, to take on the right, which many of us have been doing for years, but we need a very broad base of people who are linked in some way, connected mm-hmm. in some way, have some degree of shared values. Maybe not all the same strategies, maybe not all the same tactics, but, you know, in some sort of real connection with one another, that they have a common threatening issue that becomes more and more, you know, I want to say a life and death issue, but it's a little bit heavy, but it is.
A little bit heavy, yes.
Yeah. You know, it's been ever since I started working on the, you know, watching the right, studying the right, writing about the right, people are like, Suzanne, you're awfully dark.
Oh, they don't know the half.
But I should just say, I run with Scott Nakagawa. What do you expect?
I did not teach you that. You taught me that. This podcast is presented by the 22nd Century Initiative, a hub for strategy and action for frontline activists, national leaders, and people like you.
At 22ci.org, you can sign up for our newsletter. You can learn from our anti-authoritarian playbook, which includes resources on how to block rising authoritarianism, bridge across the multiracial majority, and build an inclusive pro-democracy movement in your community.
So, you know, I mean, you mentioned money and we talked about Reagan earlier, and I do think it's important to note for people in the audience who didn't live through it, as Sue and Suzanne and I have, that up until the Reagan administration, the world looked somewhat different. And since the Reagan administration and the introduction of neoliberalism into our politics, you know, a lot of what we used to think of as government services have devolved to nonprofits. And now today, you know, many years after the election of Reagan, we have so many nonprofits, too many by my account. They've become the primary means through which people try to achieve social justice. At least, you know, the most sustained, consistent efforts are housed in nonprofit organizations. And so the big money question is a big question in all of that, right? Because we are forced to compete for money in that sector. And then we call ourselves democratic organizations, but let's be real. You know, I mean, it's not like a neighborhood election is held to decide who runs the community food bank in your neighborhood. And so we find ourselves having to use very imperfect tools in order to achieve the ends that we're trying to achieve, and in the middle of a kind of an emergency. So, you know, it's just really helpful to hear your reflections.
I want to take us back to work that the two of you did together in Oregon on the No on Nine campaign. Voters were presented with a state constitutional amendment that would have described LGBTQ people as abnormal, wrong, unnatural, and perverse. It would have made LGBTQ people the social equivalent of pedophiles, and it would forever ban civil rights protections for people on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. And yet, you won. Can the two of you reflect a bit on the positive outcomes of that very important and historic campaign?
Yeah, I think we could probably go on an hour or two. I just want to say, when I was in the campaign, and when I think back on the campaign, I have never had such joy politically as that. And that is, I think that's kind of an extraordinary thing to hear someone say that about something that was long and hard work and had conflict and had violence, you know, had so many aspects to it. I think it had so many things that it gave us that we were able, and I give a lot of credit to Scott. Scott and I worked hand in hand through much of that campaign. It was Scott who asked me to come to Oregon and spend time there, because I had met him at a conference at Center for Democratic Renewal, where we were talking about issues such as this. And then we met up at a Creating Change conference. So I think one of the things that we did together, and other people may say they did these together too, was to move the link of racism and homophobia together, to actually see this campaign as an attack on something larger than the queer community. To move it to where it had was basically being able at that time to talk about an answer to the question you had earlier about how did people learn about things. This was one of the things that the campaign did, was offer that opportunity for people to learn about what we're facing and where it's going. And we spent a lot of time, which I think is the great success of the campaign, on the ground constantly talking with people. Talking with church people, getting them involved, talking with labor, getting them involved, and then just doing constant living room or kitchen table conversations with people, which was mainly about political education. There was a lot of strategy in the campaign, but it was a tremendous amount of political education. And I think that the fact that we were insistent from day one. And there's a little bit of, you know, other history that could come in another time. There was two campaigns, basically, an official campaign and then another one that ran within that. But that we took on and went deliberately into rural areas to do organizing, to engage not just people who lived along the state, but to engage people on the ground throughout the state. So the result of that, I think, was the expanded progressive base, you know, that we brought in, that then knew what was being talked about, knew the threat, and was able to, and then we as a campaign were able to move this, our understanding from the state to nationally to internationally. We got press that moved through all of those so that we were able to talk on a larger platform that you would have expected. So I think it, in some ways, this campaign prepared the country for this right-wing strategy because it was a hot spot of attention. And part of that was our doing, was that our deliberate using the press, using workshops across the country, making speeches everywhere we could outside of the state of Oregon, to constantly move this message. It was, I think, one of the significant moments in movement history, the way in which people came together at that time in such a large way and such a diverse way of, some people were workers, some people were people who had lots of money, some people, it was like getting everybody to understand this is about you. And this in particular is about people of color, and it has a larger strategy. And the larger strategy is about dismantling things that are already in place for protections, taking them away, which is exactly where we are now, looking at the protections and organizing to take those protections away. And so we need that kind of collectivity and that arm-to-arm working together.
Well, for context, because this was 32 years ago, it was a long time ago, not in the lived experience of many, many people who may be listening to this podcast. Oregon faced a similar ballot measure in 1988, similar in that it attacked queers. In 1988, Governor Neil Goldschmidt of Oregon signed an executive order into being that banned discrimination against public employees on the basis of sexual orientation and identity. That particular executive order was rolled back by ballot measure by a group called the Oregon Citizens Alliance, what we would nowadays call a Christian nationalist group, but we then thought of as an evangelical conservative group. The Oregon Citizens Alliance basically placed this question on the ballot about whether or not public employees should enjoy this protection, and used ads that characterized gay men as sexual predators of young boys in order to make their case, and then they won. Right. They lost in court subsequently around, First Amendment issues, but they did, in fact, win at the ballot box. And so 4 years later, they came back, having learned that attacking queers by ballot could earn you a lot of money for your political action committee and also help you to build bridges to power throughout Oregon politics. So in 1992, they came back with the Abnormal Behaviors Initiative. The early polling showed that we were in a pretty tight situation, in spite of how extreme the question was. And that really put the fear of God into us. We brought Suzanne because we knew that Suzanne would be able to help us and bring perspectives that we didn't have in Oregon and help to kind of expand our sense of what the options were for what we could do. But one of the key things, as Suzanne mentioned, was to make this a bigger issue than queer, right? In 1988, when the Oregon Citizens Alliance attacked Oregon, the campaign opposing their ballot measure basically suggested that the queer community quiet down until Election Day. A national coming out day event actually got canceled or was attempted to be canceled in order to be able to avoid polarizing things before Election Day in a way that would be unfavorable to the queer community. By 1992, we learned that that was wrong, that we would never debate at any point whether or not queer people should be visible, loud, proud. We just began in every conversation with the assumption that queer is good and that we weren't going to debate it. But we did make the argument that whether you like queer people or didn't, whether you held prejudicial views or your religious affiliation caused you to think of queer people as beyond the pale, you still needed to ask yourself a question. Do you want that attitude to become the law and, in fact, to become a constitutional matter in the state that would change the way that civil rights were understood and protected for everyone? And that seemed to have a big impact. And it opened the door to so many things happening. African Americans voting no on 9, people of faith voting no on 9, people of color voting no on 9, the emergence of a network of rural organizations now under the leadership of the Rural Organizing Project, and the eventual emergence of Oregon's first statewide political organization, Basic Rights Oregon, which now is one of the most effective LGBTQ organizations in the country. It took the place of something, just to give you some sense of this historical trajectory, of something called the Right to Privacy Pact, which chose that name specifically in order to avoid putting the words lesbian, gay, bisexual, etc. on envelopes, on mailers. And so that was a big shift that happened. A lot of different things changed. And, you know, I think you will agree with me, Suzanne. It was as if the religious right in Oregon had awakened a sleeping giant. They had no idea that the queer movement was cross-class, cross-race, from every walk of life, and that we were connected to so many different kinds of people, including our families, but also the people we worked with, the people we played with, that we were not the isolated, beleaguered, you know, marginalized community that they imagined us to be, that we were, in fact, everywhere. And I think that they may find that now, as they are attacking queers all over the country. I don't know what you think about that, but you know, it is one of the things that I take away from this moment, or from that moment in 1992, that gives me hope now.
No, I agree with you that on that. I think we might need a little more push for people to understand that we're the sleeping lion. That people in our movement are very well aware that there are queers everywhere, but understand if we get to the point where people understand, not only are there queers everywhere in great numbers, they're all standing up. It's the standing up part, I think, we're at the edge of now that we need to make happen.
And we did learn to do that via both the AIDS crisis and I think in some ways the marriage equality movement.
Yes.
That there was immense solidarity across all kinds of lines in both of those movements. So, yeah, I think it's time for some more of that, eh?
Yeah, and I think it can't be. I mean, there was a time when it was like a queer movement, you know, kind of a thing of itself. Right now, we need to be in full alignment around the body, I think, you know, about our bodily autonomy, the idea that we own our bodies. And because there's a large coalition waiting to be made there with tremendous power, I think, because it's one of the, you know, the key elements of authoritarianism is to manage and control that body. And Lord knows we see it around the world right now as well as here. So I think there's tremendous power in that. I don't think we have great power if we don't connect. Then we are just, you know, we're singers and intellectuals and, you know, whatever. But this, to say we have one thing that we know is at the center of authoritarianism. There's more than one thing at the center, but we know this one thing is at the center as well, which is that bodily autonomy and who owns one's body, who controls that body.
Yeah, and they want to control a majority of people in this country.
That's right. So it's a great place for alignment, you know. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how would we move to that alignment? And I urge it on the local level, you know, in a smaller city or a smaller town, you don't have many people to stand up for your singular cause. So it becomes a little clearer that if you don't get with the others, you know, you're going to get kicked in the butt. Yeah. And I also think that we can align around the family. Because there are plenty of people looking for not just a redefinition of family, but an affirmation of those shifts in definition and having the same rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that family question's a big one, isn't it? Especially now because of the changing economy that we're in. You know, so many of us have to migrate for work, and fewer and fewer of us all the time now who have families live in situations where we can expect our children to live in the same community and work in that community that we have always lived in. And so many things threaten the family And as a source of comfort, it makes it more and more appealing.
I think we are working hard to replace it with a sense of community. Mm-hmm. You know, because we don't have our blood kin or the people we were raised with near us. I would love to see the stats on that. I mean, I'm sure it's enormous separation. But always within the queer community, there's been mm-hmm. that desire for community, you know, and yep. we use the language of family among us.
But right? That in these contexts where we redefine family in the context of community, what is the role of the patriarch?
Patriarch's in trouble.
Yeah. Patriarch's in big trouble, right? Too many eyes. You know, we forget that, for instance, you know, that whole idea of domestic violence as a horrible crime and one that needed to be subject to public action came about partly as a result of urbanization, that suddenly people were forced to live closer together. That's and right. So the sounds that came from homes in which people were violently being assaulted were heard by everyone and raised a moral question for the community. Right? Mm-hmm. That was a direct challenge to the authority of the patriarch. And similarly, I think we face some of those kinds of things now as, you know, arrangements shift, the way that we relate to each other, how we are arranged in families, how we are arranged in communities shift, that status threats are ignited for those who have always been the qualified one, right? The ones mm-hmm. who's mm-hmm. naturally in charge and may ignite their desire to characterize the rest of us as far less qualified, in fact, maybe incompetent to run things as women have been characterized for so long and as children always are characterized. All of these things seem to just keep going back to the family.
Mm-hmm. I think so as well.
So, you know, Suzanne, over all these years, I mean, we've known each other since 1990 because I remember longer than you do. I actually met you because my organization of the time, the Coalition for Human Dignity, brought you to Portland State University to speak at a very seminal International Women's Day event. I mean, you came in and you kicked ass. Many things got catalyzed by that speech. But that's a long time to be rolling together. And over that time, I've always seen you as a person who plays social change as a game of chess, not checkers, right? And especially when countering the authoritarian movement. So, you know, one of the ways that I have seen you evolve and where I've seen you do some really good work is with the Southern Movement Assembly. You are in touch with people who are doing work all over the place. And having spoken with somebody from the Southern Movement Assembly this morning, I can tell you, you know, I mean, the Southern Movement Assembly in May will be in Nairobi, meeting with people there, bringing people from the African diaspora to Nairobi to develop strategies. So it's really come to scale in a really remarkable way. Mm-hmm. So tell us some about that. You know, like what are you winning and what's giving you hope in the context of all of this remarkable work you're involved in?
I would say the winning part is gathering in people who are disconnected from one another in terms of movement work. So when I talk about the competition among organizations, the Southern Movement Assembly brings those groups in. We call it organizations and formations that, you know, are not nonprofits. And place them in the same room with one another, or the same gathering place with one another. And it's not our job to be in the kind of win-lose category of, you know, taking on an issue and fighting together to win it. That it's more about figuring out governance is one thing, in that it started with Katrina, after Katrina, when we realized government and governance as we know it was non-existent. And that was a shocking wake up for all of us. The recognition from that was that Walmart and churches were doing more for New Orleans than our movement people were across the South, because we were not in place. We were not geared up to do that. So this is more approaching that. How do you gear up? How do you, you know, give people access to training and political education and connection so that they are ready? And, you know, when things do occur, we can move together, but we're not always looking. Let's just figure out, you know, a goal to take down this. We're not all focused on Cop City, but many of our folks are focused on Cop City, but the SMA itself is not focused on that. So we get news from the front lines across the South. We share work, we share intel, we share skills, and then this whole notion of practicing how you do governance outside of the systems, you know, that we have set up. And we hold every Monday we meet. This is for 11 years now, except for a holiday. We meet and we're in discussion of what's happening in the South and in the governance of that. And we're held together by principles of unity. So together we created those, and that's how you come in, is under an agreement and acknowledgement of the principles of unity, which leads to a shared politic, not a single politic, but a shared. And it's not a nonprofit. And the tools that we're working on now is the what you mentioned, people's movement assemblies. So an example of that is we're having a organizing school. We'll be at a place that has historic meaning, and we'll take about 50 people. It's a first timer for us, but it speaks to our goals very, very well. And we're going to spend a day when talking about the history, part of the history of what the place we're in. And a lot of that will be about citizenship schools, which are almost a perfect model of how you do organizing. You know, that you do it, you meet people where they are, you meet their needs that they have, you know, all of that. It's like a step-by-step thing. And some conversation about how those came out of a workshop, that idea, you know, a workshop at Highlander, and then how they were able to develop from that, which is remarkable. You know, at the end, they had, toward the last days, they had 20,000 teachers trained who were just ordinary people, not school teachers, to do these. And a bazillion people were ready in 1969 to vote. So we do that. We'll have scenarios, which are dark, because I was in charge of writing the scenarios. You can imagine, so forth. Then we'll focus on the use of a People's Movement Assembly as a tool, of how you use that as a way to gather people. And it's, you know, it's outside of the nonprofit system, even though nonprofit organizations will be involved in it. It's a tool for gathering and making decisions. And then the next day of organizing will be a lot about how you get yourself in a place to be able to act on those decisions. And then this summer, we'll have a summer of PMAs, that there will be groups around the South that will hold them in their communities. And then in late September, we'll have our big assembly, which will be a couple of hundred people coming for 3 days to both talk about, share what they have done and build on that, but also to lay out what they would like for us to be focusing on in the next year. And it's been a slow build. You know, we learned it as we went, but it has I think lifted the political skills and political awareness and political connected movement aware of their skills and connectedness in the South.
Suzanne, you and I have learned together over many years now that authoritarians have basically drawn a kind of a gender and race line between liberty and justice for all, to use a phrase too often used, perhaps, given our situation in the United States about ourselves. But, you know, it's just really impressive to me how early on you recognized that and set your eyes on liberation and didn't give it up. Nowadays, the polling shows that we should be talking about freedom. and not just rights. But you have always been that person to me. So thanks for that.
You bet.
Suzanne, you are one of the sages of the South. You live in Little Rock, Arkansas. Can you talk a little bit about the ways you see the authoritarian strong man, strong woman practices and philosophy on the ground in Arkansas and what the Arkansasoyers are doing to resist?
Arkansans.
I just learned that word, Arkansasoyer.
We don't use that.
All right. I won't ever use it again. But can you talk a little bit about what's happening there on the ground and what's the resistance?
I want to just give a little list of before I start so that people don't think, Arkansas is a hellhole. You know, Arkansas actually is a grand place. It's some beautiful, beautiful scenery and the outdoor life is awfully good, and people work really hard here. So I was going to start. I had my little notes for this, that it's the land of Daisy Bates, Johnny Cash, Bill Clinton, and Maya Angelou. That ain't bad. One might be more questionable than others. And it's also the land of the heroic, and I think it is heroic, integration of Central High School. And it is the land of the Elaine Massacre, which was an attack against a black forming labor union. And it killed the most black people in one location in the U.S. So it is that land, you know, that combination of extraordinary people and our current governor. So, and I'd also say that the integration of Central High in 1957 was helped and created by the work of the NAACP and a black-owned newspaper, and Daisy Bates and her husband owned that newspaper. So, I think in terms of lessons to be learned about organizing, that's very well positioned to have a local. A national organization that has strong local roots and a newspaper that is for the people and represents the people who are fighting. So, and I don't know if that's ever emphasized enough, but I think that's really important. So it was not one woman. There's always a lot of conflict here about, you know, what her role was and everybody else's role. Lots and lots of people had roles in that. But Daisy herself, Ms. Bates, was an extraordinary, extraordinary woman. So we are, you know, just a good state to study, I think, in seeing how authoritarianism spreads. It spread to the, it already had roots here, but it spread to this state through a president and the selection of governors to carry out specific goals, which is around the country now in large number of places. So we got the press secretary. We got Sarah Huckabee Sanders, whose father had been a moderate, mostly moderate, I think, Republican here as governor. And she came in like a firestorm with plans already in place that would decimate public schools and promote private schools, that they would take down any of the gender discussions or liberties. So they would attack both, you know, libraries and schools and trans kids and the Freedom of Information Act to take away a big chunk of that, particularly a chunk that relates to her, to have an act to criminalize librarians. They had an immediate signing of an all abortion, all the time bill. So able to do that with a significant vote in her favor that hardly had to do, and just piles of money, hardly had to do any, you know, election work to make it happen. And I'm happy to say the state, people in the state are standing up. I went to a rally this Sunday about abortion. And it's because a group of people are putting it on the ballot. And to do that is a huge amount of work. Because in this state, you have to get signatures from all 90-something counties. And that's hard to do, to have a certain number of signatures by that. But the rally is organizing, that rally was part of the organizers who have been working for some time now. But this is true for every one of these bills. You had to go to every county. And so, you know, there's big stop gaps. Then there's another group that's working on to save the Freedom of Information Act. And there's another one that's fighting, you know, the criminalization of librarians. There's a group that, and then there's people doing stuff like trying to maybe stop her order that In God We Trust has to be up in every classroom in the state. And her order that public funding from our taxes will go to private schools. So there's a fight back, more than there was last year and the year before. So I think it's significant that that's happening. It's why I think never give up on a place like Arkansas and never give up on the South. I think that we have made really critical mistakes in our organizing, that we lost before COVID, well before COVID, we lost the conviction and belief that you have to work with people on the ground and you have to talk to them about things that are essential to them and essential to their beliefs, their values, their needs, particularly their needs. You can't ignore them. You can't either just keep yourself in offices or just do protests. And that is how the right was able to rise. We were not having the counter conversations. We did not develop a counter strategy. For me, it's important to acknowledge that. That when I tell the story of working against the right and my involvement coming gradually out of the Women's Project, you know, as we faced the Good News Methodists, that's the church that was, they were our 501c3, you know, they managed our money for the first 5 years. And the Good News Methodists were trying to take us out of that and take us apart. And then facing the Klan and, you know, watching all of that develop over the 80s. And so coming into my work and understanding of the right slowly, you know, writing about it from the late 70s, but, you know, just chunks, it took time to get the chunks of it put together in my mind. So by the time Scott and I met, you know, he showed me the video, Gay Rights, Special Rights, and I was like, oh, this is not about queers, this is about civil rights. And now I understand it's more than that. So I think that we have missed a lot. So I think we had to pivot and figure out how we work on the ground and how we work in the respect and development of community. I think we can do that. But I think that we can't depend entirely on tech, you know, because we're not working with people who have a lot of tech, you know. We have to find ways. And I think these PMAs are an example of that. I think there are many, many other examples. Part of it is just participating in other people's issues. But I've been a little distressed to see such an attack against libraries and not see a queer strategy on that nationwide. I mean, that's kind of astounding to me that nationally we're not talking about that, you know? Mm-hmm. How to have an intersectional strategy where we take that on. We would say, like hell, you're going to take our students in schools and limit them from the kind of education that they deserve in these particular ways that you're, you know, attacking. I think there's just a lot of work for us right now. And we got enough people to take it on. We need to round them up.
You reference the struggle at Little Rock Central High School, which was in 1957. a long time ago now, right? Mm-hmm.
The year I graduated from high school. Well, I remember it.
Okay. Well, you know, when Little Rock Central High School was integrated and the Little Rock Nine was sent to be the front line, you know, the governor of the time, Orville Faubus, opposed it, right? And it took Dwight D. Eisenhower to force the school district to allow those students to attend school, right?
Exactly.
We had at the time. Yes, we had at the time leverage at the federal level. Mm-hmm. We may not have that kind of leverage nowadays. And there is a danger of preemption, right, at the local level. So that all the things that we're doing locally could be threatened under the wrong kind of federal administration. So what's your advice to people organizing in this time about the what's durable? What can last? What will serve us going forward into what could be a much more repressive future?
Well, you mean what's durable given the potential of destruction all the time?
Yeah.
I think the one thing that has been durable for me all my life is collective deep relationships with individuals, but also with organizations that have depth, you know. So it's basically, I think it's basically having a sense that what that your relationships have such depth that they were going to be able to sustain themselves, like given a terrible scenario where we will not maybe be able to communicate each with one another, other if the grid goes down, to be in the deep kind of relationships with those you live around and among, you know, whether it's city or small town, that there's someone to turn to. I think that's where the durability comes from. And I think that takes work. I think that takes, you know, talking about real issues, real things, and being willing to, you know, come to some sort of agreement. Also think that's the way, like you brought up the battered women's movement. That's the way it started. You know, a few women saying, oh my goodness. And you know, the way many of us learned about it was because of consciousness raising groups. Those were phenomenal and have sustained, you know, those relationships, some of them now for 40 or 50 years. But that's the first time many of us ever heard people say out loud, I've been raped. First time we heard people say, you know, he beats me. He beats the children. I go with broken bones to the hospital. But out of that, we built something that we could have kept out of the hands of the government. But I don't know any of this, whether we can have any success if we're not finding some extraordinary ways to replace capitalism mm-hmm. in our daily lives. There's the big picture capitalism, but there's the way capitalism has us in its grasp. How can we force that loose and free ourselves? So that combination of things, you know, that and the change of culture when you're under that grasp so terribly as we are in this country, it's hard to think that you can do things without mm-hmm. without a sum of money, you know.
Yeah.
That you get, you know, stopped all the time by mm-hmm. thinking, oh, but we would have to have this and this and this and this, or we'd never be able to do it. Whereas I think with the starting of the women's anti-violence movement was, you come to my home. It wasn't, can I get a grant to keep you? You know, you come to my home and I'll see what I can do for you. And then realizing, you know, mm-hmm. we're all putting ourselves in danger too. How can we create something that won't put everyone in danger, but we can still participate in it? Mm-hmm. So I think for me, that's not on a huge level. That's on a small level, but I'm pretty convinced that's how we have to move now. you know, link the best we can in large ways. But if we're not moving in those small ways, it's, you know, it doesn't matter too much. Well, that's a pretty negative way to end, isn't it?
I love that you referenced the battered women's movement because, you know, it was a movement that started off trying to restore the victim and not primarily to punish the victimizer, right?
That's
to
right.
Figure out how to come up with solutions in the context of community. And all of that begins with trusting people and being able to form deep, lasting relationships. And as a final word, that's a great one because it's something everyone can do.
Right. So thank you for making me a part of your first podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for being our first guest.
Yeah, we put you first because we were not scared of you.
That's good.
Hey, thanks again for listening. Find more episodes of the Anti-Authoritarian Podcast on all of your favorite platforms and also at 22ci.org and convergencemag.org. Direct links to these and other resources referenced in this episode are in the show notes.
The Anti-Authoritarian Podcast is created by the 22nd Century Initiative and published by Convergence Magazine. Our theme music is After the Revolution by Carsey Blanton and is licensed under Creative Commons. The show is hosted by Scott Nakagawa and Sue Hyde. Executive producers are James Mum and Tony Esbridge. Our producer is Josh Elstro, and Yong Chan Miller is our production assistant.